I'm going to ask Paul to stay up here, and then I'm going to ask the other three speakers and the three panelists also to come up here to discuss some of these issues now of the history of the Antarctic Treaty, as we have just heard some of. The other three I'll speak a little bit about, because there's nothing in your document that says anything about them, and I'll take them in the order, if you like, of the way they are here. Maybe not. I'll start with the oldest, and without, please sit down. As I, in any way you like. It would be nice to have the women somewhat spread around. But the first one I'll talk about is Fred Roots, and you. I'm sure I don't apologize to you, or I don't have to, Fred, when I say you are the oldest. Fred Roots started his career in Antarctica in 1949. He was part of the very well-known Norwegian-British-Swedish expedition to Mordheim, and he's been active in the polar scene ever since, I think that's fair to say. Most recently, for many, many, many years, he's been involved in Canada's delegation to the Antarctic Treaty consultative meetings. He's been a senior advisor within the Canadian government on the Arctic, more perhaps so, than, but even so also in the Antarctic. And I don't know what it is, but Fred and the other two people I mentioned before who were at the IGY are all geologists. I wonder whether you live longer or something, or you are active longer, I should say, because he's still active. The other person I just mentioned is Arnt Elsinger from Sweden. Arnt is a professor of philosophy of science, but also involved with the history of science. He has been was professor at the University of Gothenburg more than 20 years ago. I myself met him first time in 1991, or just before that, when he organized a seminal meeting at that time. And you will all know that in 1991, it was 30 years ago that the Antarctic Treaty was entered into, and the discussion was, at that time, or at least in 1889, 1890, the worry was that the Antarctic Treaty might not last beyond 30 years. That was not the only worry, but the background for that was that within the Antarctic Treaty, there is a provision that after 30 years, any party can ask for a meeting. And following that meeting, within a couple of years more, a party can decide to withdraw from the treaty. In other words, there was an exclusion clause or a dissolution clause that would enter into after 30 years. If no party asked for such a conference, of course, the treaty goes on, and that's what happened. The treaty went on. But in 1989, when the minerals negotiations had completed and then they were not ratified, then it was a pretty heated period for the Antarctic Treaty, and Arnt organized then this meeting, which discussed some of these very interesting issues. And finally, we have up here a totally different person from the point of view of the Antarctic scene, but we have with us, and I'm just going to look at my notes here to make sure I say nothing wrong, Dr. Roger Lonius, whose title at present is Senior Curator at the NASM Division of Space History at the Smithsonian, but he was Chief Historian at NASA from 1990 to 2002. He's written or edited more than 20 books, and he's now working and editing on a forthcoming volume which deals with the history of both IGY and the three international polar years. Now I'm going to ask the three who have not spoken each to give a couple of minutes of views on what they think they've been challenged on by spoken by the previous three talks, or any other view you think you would like to present, which especially challenges this system and perhaps can lead into a good plenary debate among the six of you. And I'm going to do it in the way I introduced you, so I'm going to start with you, Fred. You've been around for six decades, and that should give you a background for being somewhat provocative, please. You don't have to stand up. I think you should be working from the mic here.
Well, I thank you very much, Olaf. And that, does my machine work okay? Yep. I'm not sure what it is that gives me the right to speak first, but because I'm one of the older people here, perhaps I can indulge in by going back a little bit farther even than my good friends Jillian and Canadia did. And I'd like to take you back to what in some ways is an important aspect of what we're dealing with here, which is the governance of not closely occupied territories. And take you back to a remarkable document presented to Queen Elizabeth of England in 1580, after Martin Frobisher's first voyage from Britain to North America. On that voyage, his ship capsized in the middle of the Atlantic. The sails and masts went into the water. They could only recover by cutting the masts, reducing all the sails, cutting all the lines for the sails, got the ship upright again, and re-rigged the ship in mid-Atlantic and continued. And the first land that they came following that northern latitude was a land which Frobisher named Queen Elizabeth's Foreland in the honor of the reigning monarch. And we think of both Frobisher regarded with mining adventures and things like that. But he named that in the honor of his monarch. And the queen accepted that honor and asked her advisor, named John Dee, to write a document which would justify her sovereignty over unknown land. She named that land Meta Incognita, which in Latin translates into unknown boundaries. And the document produced by John Dee is a remarkable document which looks at the questions that we heard this morning from the prince. It looks at the rights of discovery, the rights of occupation, and the rights of the geographical proximity. And it states in that remarkable document the folklore, the background of knowledge of the polar regions, this was the northern polar regions only anyway, up to and including the North Pole. And that document, although it didn't have any immediate aspects on the exploration aspects, although some historians might put that together, had an undoubted effect on the fact that that country in which it had felt it had a reason to look into unknown lands and polar regions as part of a national duty. And it's led to a whole group in succeeding centuries of unknown lands being claimed by the countries or by the sovereign. At that time, there was no other lands that were named, unknown lands named by a monarch. And result, we had, for instance, in Antarctica, they had the seven claimant states and an area unclaimed, but very noticeably unclaimed. And so you can follow the history quite well. And I think that is important as part of the background of why we need to look at the deeper issues and historical issues that lie behind the issues for the 21st century for Antarctica. I'd like to jump ahead a little bit more. And Cornelia mentioned the Neue Schwabenland expedition and the photographs that were taken by the Germans at that time of inland part of Antarctica, south from South Africa. And there, for the first time, there were clear pictures of mountain glaciers. And there, they excited the attention of Professor Almond from Sweden, who had been studying the glacier history of the North Atlantic from Svalbard through Greenland to North America, all around the North Atlantic. And he had began to put together a history of the climate changes that affected the landscape in high latitudes. And he was very interested to know whether or not these were regionally confined to the North Atlantic, or were they worldwide? And the end result of that, without taking time here, was, of course, the Norwegian-British-Swedish expedition, which had underneath it, underneath all of the politics that Cornelia mentioned, It had a basic scientific purpose, and the scientific one was one which was not considered very important at that time. That was climate change. How important is it to a region or to a climate, to a planet? And on that directing group who advised on the Norwegian-British Free Trade Commission, which I happened to be on, there were people who were involved in the second International Polar Year. And so the concept of coordination and multidisciplinary as well as scientifically specialized activities was well carried over from IPY2 to the Norwegian-British Free Trade Expedition and eventually led to a great deal of the discussion that led to the third IPY, which then became the International Geophysical Year. And so what I think the perspective that I want to bring here now is that the idea first of needing governance in an unknown land, as exposed by Meta Incognita, which we could apply to Antarctica still today without known boundaries. They're known geographically, but they're not known scientifically or knowledgeably or even culturally, to the fact that a specific scientific problems, such as the global or regional aspects of climate change and the need for cooperation between scientific disciplines as well as between countries and institutions, became the background to the treaty that we're trying to celebrate here. So that's a perspective I'd like to leave with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. I will ask the next speakers to be slightly shorter, if I may, because I would want to have some interaction between you if that happens. But I'll now give the floor to Arne, please.
Okay, well, my approach to Antarctic Treaty, IGY, etc., is partly analytical and historical. Hans Ullmann, we heard, was interested in climate change. At the time, he called it climate betterment, and those were the terms of the discussion in those days, which shows you that we have to be careful about the terminology that's used. That changes with time. Now, one of the things that I sort of am concerned about is our historical view about the past. And I maintain there are three different approaches to the Antarctic Treaty, the IGY. There's the naive view, which holds that, and this used to be dominant, that politics was set on one side, and then we had peace and we had science. There's the opposite view, the cynical view, which maintains that both the IGY and the advent of the Antarctic Treaty were permeated by politics all the way. Now, I sort of advocate a middle range view in between these two, which I call critical realism. And within that, and I think also as the Cold War archives have opened up, we've got a lot of new scholarship that has shown that there was much more politics around in the body of the science also than we previously were aware of. The principle of sovereign neutrality was a remarkable mechanism for keeping conflict at bay. But there was also the question of carrying out atomic tests. And during all these secret meetings between the United States and the Soviet Union, I think the records I've seen is where the Soviet Union was pressing for banishing atomic tests from the Antarctic. And delegates in the United States were a little bit more waffling on this point and thought, well, yeah, not military atomic tests, but maybe civilian atomic tests. Now, I think it's unfortunate that we don't have more representatives from the Russians and the Eastern European states, because it would be nice to balance the whole record of the past and all these 60 secret negotiations that were going on. We know very little about this record. As far as I'm concerned, the remarkable thing in the genius of the Antarctic Treaty and the IGY is not altruism, It was not that that politics was set aside. On the contrary, it was realism, pragmatism, and compromise on the basis of mutual benefit and sort of containing conflict so it wouldn't spill over onto the Antarctic, because there were enough conflict to keep people busy in the Arctic. And it would be very costly also to be engaged down there. So it was a question of mutual benefit. I think the key thing was the two superpowers came to an accommodation on that point. It would be cheaper and probably more beneficial, not to lock in arms on the southern continent down there. The other genius thing, I think, about the Antarctic Treaty is that it set up science as a mechanism for inclusion and exclusion of nations. Substantial scientific research, which has then been reinterpreted several times during the course of the Antarctic Treaty. But this means that then science had a dual function. For the scientists, you could do advanced knowledge, but also for the politicians and the legal experts and so on, science was a way of manifesting a country's presence. That is, the new countries that were being enrolled into the Antarctic Club, science was your way of manifesting your presence and your interest on the continent and to be part of the management of the future of Antarctica. So anyway, science is a kind of a symbolic capital on the political arena. And I think that's another interesting point. But at the same time, and now we're looking into the future, it opens up the question of what is scientific internationalism? How far has scientific internationalism progressed with the Antarctic Treaty? And here I want to just briefly outline three dimensions analytically. First, there's internationalism as an epistemological principle, that is, within knowledge. Truth knows no boundaries. It's there for everyone. It's the principle of universalism, also advocated by Robert Merton as part of the ethos of science. Secondly, there's the dimension of internationalism as an organizational principle, the need to cooperate and exchange results, division of labor, and organized skepticism, that is, peer review of articles and so on before things get published. Thirdly, another dimension of internationalism I call the welfare principle. That is solidarity. The application of the fruits of science should benefit all mankind, and there's a distribution of goods. Now, this was formulated within the context of science by Joseph Needham, 1947, in connection with UNESCO, when UNESCO was created, and also Julian Huxley, who was the first director general of UNESCO. Needham called it the periphery principle. That is, now this science has been developed in the Western world, and now it also should benefit the third, what we now call the third world. And I think we can ask ourselves now, in what respect has the Antarctic Treaty both facilitated but also put some boundaries on the extent to which scientific internationalism in all these three dimensions can be developed? And I think there the International Polar Commission you mentioned. Arctowski already had the idea that the International Polar Commission should be as SCAR today as also was in the Constitution, the statute of SCAR. The first draft Constitution said SCAR should organize and be responsible for the coordination of research. And this, I think it was Keith Bullen who prided himself and reported back to the Australian government that I managed to get that clause out of SCAR's statutes because it's too interventionistic. It has political implications. Now, these are the kinds of things that are still with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Arndt. And finally,
cool. Well, there's many things I could say. I'll confine myself to, I think, three areas briefly to move the conversation along. I agree with much of what my colleague had to say here. And would extend a couple of comments beyond that. The first one is, and the most important one is, that the Antarctic Treaty is fundamentally a product of the Cold War environment of the time in which it was written. I don't believe that there's any question about that. There are some other trends that are very important, but not quite as significant as that particular item. We've heard this morning, and we're all aware of the necessity of the great powers, especially the two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, to essentially cordon off Antarctica from competition. They're engaged in this Cold War struggle. It's a very desperate sort of activity, but the strategic location for that is not Antarctica or not in other parts of the world other than Europe and certain sections of Asia. Consequently, the United States, and that's not, as an American historian, I approach things through that lens. The United States was committed to achieving its political objectives in Antarctica, and perhaps the best one might have been their control over it, but absent that, which they realized was not going to be successful, let's just prohibit anybody from staking a serious claim there, and that's ultimately what happened. The Eisenhower administration made that particular case very strongly. They did it successfully. They were able to, and this is a second point that I would make, they were able to ride the success of the International Geophysical Year with its commitment to science and international collaboration as a horse that would carry them to this particular conclusion in 1959. And that was a very powerful force for them. I would suggest that collaboration, and obviously the predecessors that set its stage, the IPYs of the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, was something that they could use effectively. Scientific internationalism, as we've already heard, was useful along those lines. There's a third area that I think is important to think about when you start talking about the milieu in which the Antarctic Treaty was written. And that is the post-colonialism of that particular era. That's a major theme in history at this particular point in time. It has not necessarily been brought to bear on the study of Antarctica the way it probably will be in the future, but that's a major area. As the European great powers of the 19th century and earlier began to divest themselves of their colonies, not necessarily because they wanted to, but because they had to. The culture was such that a colonial empire in Antarctica was not going to be acceptable in the international world to virtually anybody, and certainly the great powers were a part of that as well. With those three comments, I will yield the rest of the time, and we can carry on.
Thank you. I can see we're only going to have time for some short interventions, but is there something any of you six would like to say to challenge anybody else to say? What you said was absolutely stupid or close to it. Is there some kind of challenge between you? Are you all in total agreement? Well, maybe, but I'm going to ask you first. Are there any of you who want to challenge any of the others? We're talking now about the history of the establishment of the Antarctic Treaty.
Well, perhaps I could follow up on the point that you've made.
Sure.
I think you're quite right, of course, to describe the genesis of the treaty in the Cold War and the need to prevent that scramble for Antarctica mm-hmm. that they've been writing about. But what would be your view of the way in which it has subsequently evolved, because the agendas and fears and concerns have changed so dramatically
right.
in 50 years? I'd be curious to know how you would analyze and think about that as an historian.
Yeah, I think some of the dynamics that gave rise and sustained the Antarctic Treaty were fundamentally altered in the aftermath of the Cold War. I don't think that the conditions are the same. And while I don't have a prescription for that, I'm a historian, not somebody who's a prognosticator. I would ask the question, which is kind of semi-historical, which is if you had a situation today in which there was no treaty regime in place in Antarctica, and you had various great powers there asserting whatever claims that they might want to assert or trying to keep people from asserting claims, do you think that a similar structure would be created had there not been one already in place? And I don't really think so. in our current environment because it's so different from that bipolar world of the maybe literally bipolar of the Cold War era. I don't know. You may have something to say.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree with you in that way also because I think two of the aspects that have continued. One is the science serving as a kind of a mutual confidence building process, which Paul has taken up in various contexts, that this has been very important. And then you get all the other conventions within the Antarctic Treaty system. And the other is the incrementalism, the stepwise process, so that you get a kind of a mutual interlinking and interlinking with other legal arrangements in the world and so on. But I think one of the challenges is just this, what Klaus Dodds calls the engagement with the post-colonial or the post-colonial engagement with Antarctica. And there I think the challenge is how to open up, how to increase the participation of countries in a way where you don't just have to put a station there or to reinterpret substantial scientific research, perhaps to develop some instruments to have international stations, like you have within the world of astronomy. You have the European Southern Observatory with telescopes in Chile, where I think it's Chile is given 5% of the time on these telescopes. I mean, opening it up to also invite participants from other nations, not on the station with the national flag, but some other flag, maybe SCAR's flag, I don't know.
UN flag.
Okay, well, yeah.
I think we have the example of the Aeroarctic to establish this airship transarctic air route. The aim was to get all the countries involved which were crucial for establishing such an air route, especially Russia. So we had also in Germany at that time, we still had a very strong German-Russian link. So it was quite normal to ask the Russians to get a big part of the Aeroarctic system and not the Americans. So the route would be on the Arctic, on the Russian Arctic, and not on the Canadian-American Arctic. And for me, it's just amazing how this organization was set up to get Nansen as president, which really shows that it's not a military organization. It's pure peace. It's a peaceful organization, which was very much important for the Germans to become a new or to enter science community again because it was excluded, also as Russia was excluded of the International Research Council, and they developed so nice, and I think they are also a model for, might have been a model for SCAR, which is now doing similar things in Antarctica.
Paul? From a historical perspective, given historians, I would be interested in how nations go beyond looking at their national interests to define common interests.
Well, I mean, that's a fascinating question in lots of ways, and the answer is different in every circumstance and with every culture. There are obviously some commonalities of things that are of importance to any nation state. One of the true interesting things about Antarctica, that while there is some movement around the edges along these lines, is that this approach toward scientific internationalism is really successful, and I would suggest it's quite fragile, has really only been successful because there is no overriding strategic interests, at least of the great nations who've been involved in that, and there's no overriding economic interests as well. Were those there, I can guarantee you that this treaty would not exist for very long if you had to assert or wanted to assert because there was great wealth to be gained by going there and doing something.
But they did identify, for example, there were issues of sovereignty, territory.
Sure.
They crafted their common interest in that context as questions relating to the exercise of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So presumably if there were economic interests, they could similarly craft it in terms of a common interest.
perhaps? You want
to? Yes, I think so. And I think there are a lot of elements here that need to be thought about. And one is that this is an idea whose time has come. And this has not only been something promoted by governments. It's been promoted by NGOs, by the public. There's an enormous historical, scientific interest. Yeah. And it was an age of science and an age where I think somebody mentioned the sense of science being something that all of us have an integral role and part of. So I think those ideas have taken the regime to where it is now at the beginning of the 21st century. And that's what excites me about it. And I wouldn't personally use the language of post-colonialism. I would say what's happened here is that for reasons that related largely to the Cold War and concerns in the mid to late 50s, it has the form that it has. But by virtue of the capacity of the law to dynamically evolve, the structure was sufficiently sound to enable states to achieve their interests within that structure. And as each part has been built onto it, they've kept the key ideas of neutrality, sovereign neutrality, to protect interests and to enable the reciprocal sense of mutual advantage for all within the system. And that is, it's a very fragile balance, but one's that's actually been more resilient than one might have imagined. Particularly in those days, I was involved in the negotiations at Punta del Este for the Minerals Convention. Mm-hmm. One could never have imagined then that we would move well past that to the Madrid Protocol and liability annexes. And now we talk about our artists and the poetry and the social science interests that we have in Antarctica with much broader concerns. So I suppose what interests me as a lawyer is how very simple ideas and techniques of law have actually enabled a growth dynamically through five decades that explores and picks up an idea that became an idea for the time. And my view is that that's exactly what's going to happen in the next decades or so.
Fred, you're going to get the last word before I sum up.
I was just going to suggest in answer to Paul's question and partly to Gillian's answer that the interested nations must take in areas, things beyond their boundaries in the post-colonial system is certainly being addressed internationally this week in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. There is an issue which countries are forced to look at what happens beyond their boundaries and take some responsibility or action for it. But there are other areas of that kind. I think the whole post-colonial culture, with it, as you mentioned, is, and together with what's coming, our space program and so on, is getting people in all countries to realize that the globe is a sphere that countries are, the national countries are simply patches on it, and what happens globally is important to each of them. But at the same time, our communication and information system is asking for quick answers, simple black and white questions, which are very hard to accommodate in the way the treaty is headed. So we should have some people here to say that.
Well, today we are talking, in this session, we're talking about the past. And I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of time to speculate about the future. So I'm not going to go further on that. But I do want to make it, because I was asked to make a very short summing up. So this is going to conclude this. And if I'm now unfair to any of you, that's my problem. And you shouldn't hit me afterwards. But starting with this morning, we had Prince Albert saying, quote, transformation of scientific truth into collective choice. And we're getting back to the start of this treaty. I don't think we were actually at the stage where we had transformation of scientific knowledge into collective decisions, because the decisions, I suspect, of the Antarctic Treaty evolution and this making it was one of very few people in each country. There was no public debate, I suspect. This was the leaders, or somewhat close to the leaders, who were talking about this. But I think there was an element of science in it in a different way. And Jorge Begunyu, who you will meet later in this program, one of our Chilean leaders, he wrote many years ago about the cohesive force of a common stock of ideas and values among the scientists and the diplomats. And that was an interesting aspect, and certainly has been an extremely important aspect of what's happened to the treaty after 1959.
Now, what we've heard now in my summary is the following. We've heard Gillian Triggs talk about the claimants' need to protect their interest and gave us a thoughtful example on what we have to do when domestic legislation made in claimant nations for their domestic reasons meet the international realities of the Antarctic Treaty made for different purposes, and some challenges of that in the future, and many others. We've heard Conor Lideke talk about the parallel evolution in the Arctic and the Antarctic, suggesting maybe it broke down for a while, but I'm quite sure that's come back again today. Paul showed, especially fascinating, how Eisenhower imposed his, maybe didn't impose it, but certainly forced forward, his international visions in the evolution leading up to the Antarctic Treaty. We've heard Fred talk about the long time and memory of history, appropriately that you should do that, going back to 1580 and the start of governance, and of course later on the need for having science underpinning why we're going there. Then we have Arndt Elsinger, whose thoughts about the treaty evolution was that some think it was naive that the treaty came about, that politics didn't apply. The cynical ones say that it was the only leading force, and your opinion, which I suspect is close to reality, a critical realism, that this was a mixture of both. But I have a feeling that as history is showing us more and more, there was more political thought and there was more power going into the evolution than perhaps the scientists have liked to think, and perhaps we shouldn't overplay the role of science. And finally, we had Roger Lonius, who talked about the Antarctic Treaty as a product of the Cold War environment and the fact that the superpowers found that this was the second best solution in the U.S. Best had been to get rid of the claimants. The second best was to let them be there, but not give them more power than the U.S. could afford to. And I'll make a final point is that perhaps, unfortunately, we have a somewhat Anglo-Saxon European group here.
Yes, we do.
And so there might have been different views if there had been other parts of the geographic world sitting up there. Certainly, I don't think they would have talked about Magna Carta in the same words as were spoken earlier today. And with that, I conclude this panel, but there's one more point to come in the session, and I leave that for you, Paul. Thank you very much. I think we can go down.